From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her book, the historian Pamela Haag follows two important strands in the story of guns in America. She focuses on the Winchester family, and whether you know much about guns, you've probably heard that name. There are two of the Winchesters that interest her. Oliver, who saw the gun as a product, a way of making money, and Sarah Winchester, Oliver's daughter-in-law, who saw it quite differently. For Sarah, guns were a matter of conscience, and she was tormented by the violence they caused. She was haunted by it, literally haunted. It's a story we'll get to. Today in the program, Pamela Haag will join us to talk about how, in all the political hubbub over guns, we've forgotten those two strands. That is, guns as a business and the moral ethics of making them. Her book is called The Gunning of America. Join us after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Think about the way we talk about guns today. We talk about violence. We talk about tradition. We talk about rights. But the historian Pamela Haag says we often miss two very important parts of the story. These parts were there in the very early history of guns in this country, but we don't talk about them anymore, she says. We don't talk about guns as a business or guns as a matter of conscience. And that's what Haag focuses on in her new book. Her book is a cultural history of the gun, but she also has some suggestions for unthawing the frozen field of gun politics, as she puts it. Haag says guns didn't used to be cultural or political statements. For most of our history, they were seen as tools, and there are a lot of myths she takes on in her book. She's our guest today. She's an historian, an author, an essayist. Her work has appeared in venues like Slate and the Times of London. The title of the book, The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. We started our conversation with a ghost story that got Pamela Haag thinking about all of this. It's the story of Sarah Winchester. She's the daughter-in-law of Oliver Winchester. He's one of the pioneers in the gun industry, the man who started the Winchester Repeating Arms Company.
When I was in graduate school in New Haven, I was introduced to the story of Sarah Winchester by a friend of mine. And she was the daughter-in-law of Oliver Winchester, who was known as the Repeater Rifle King. And the story, as told, the legend, is that in the 1870s, Sarah was a spiritualist, and she had suffered all kinds of personal misfortunes. She had lost children, and her husband was quite ill from tuberculosis. And she came to believe, so the legend goes, that she was being haunted by the spirits of everyone killed by Winchester rifles. Right. And I was just captivated by this story. And it raised for me all sorts of interesting, maybe a little abstract, questions about conscience. Mm-hmm. And that was really the entry point into the gun story for me. So I'm not someone who had ever had a gun before or owned a gun. I wasn't involved in gun control politics. So I really was coming to the gun story through the ghost story and through this figure who was a shadow to Oliver Winchester's fortune.
You say in the book you wanted to believe that legend because it spoke to a question that was planted in your mind. What was the question? Was it related to that idea of conscience?
Well, I was compelled by the story because, as far-fetched as it may sound to 21st century ears, it seemed to me to provide this missing puzzle in the history of our gun culture. It was a story of imagining culpability and responsibility for death and the profound impact of guns in our culture that went way beyond the narrow confines of contract or of holding ourselves responsible only for the things that we literally and quite tangibly do. Mm. So I've heard so many, I mean, how many gun stories have I heard in my life, right? I mean, how many episodes of Gunsmoke did I watch? How many Westerns did I see? How many times did I over and over hear the gunmen's stories? And this was the very first time I had heard Sarah's story, but to me, it felt like this had a place in the history of our gun culture as well.
Yeah. What do you think, how did the word, the term gun culture change, the way you initially thought of it and the way you came to see gun culture as a term?
Yeah, I hadn't given a lot of thought to that definition. The term gun culture gets thrown around a lot, particularly after a mass shooting or a tragedy like that. And as I really delved into this, I had to challenge myself to think, well, what does a gun culture actually mean? And to me, as my research evolved and as my thinking evolved, I came to view a gun culture as a term that should mean both a certain quantity of guns. You know, you would have to have enough guns in your culture for them to really leave a footprint and really make a difference. But also the qualities attached to the gun. So it would have to be about emotions and feelings and values attached to the gun, as well as having a quantity of guns. Switzerland, for example, is a heavily armed nation in one sense. I mean, everyone is trained on rifles, and that's really more for the protection of the country and the militia. But they don't have the civilian violence with guns that we have. And I don't think that they have the same... It is a gun-identified culture, but they don't have the same kind of impassioned political and symbolic identification with guns and polarization that we have today.
You write this, you write, if every American had a gun, but we had almost no civilian gun violence, in other words, if we were more like Switzerland, then we might have a gun culture, but not a gun problem. It seems like that's the thing you're getting at, is there's a difference between a gun culture and a gun problem. We have a gun problem in this country. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. I think that regardless of an American's opinion on the Second Amendment, I don't think any Americans are comfortable with the level of civilian gun violence that we have. We are the most heavily armed civilian, have the most heavily armed civilian population with guns as well, at about 300 million. And also troublingly, we have by far the most polarizing and very hostily divided views about guns. So I don't think that there can be any doubt but that we have a problematic gun culture, both in the sense of the prevalence of gun violence and in the very unconstructive and polarized ways that we've turned guns into a major fault line politically.
You really started the project after the mass shooting at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. This was in 2012. 26 people killed, most of them children. How did that... So you were thinking about the ghost story that was sort of always in the back of your mind, but what was it about the Sandy Hook moment that made you really jump in to the project?
Well, like all of us, it was horrifying, it was shocking, and it fills you with a sense of helplessness and of bewilderment. Yeah. I mean, how could such a thing happen? I think that was a universally shared reaction, and just the tragedy was so overwhelming. And as an historian, of course, at that point, my mind did wander back to Sarah. I had put her aside for a while to work on another project, which was about marriage, actually. But I found myself returning because I had actually begun to research Sarah way back in 2007, 2008, but she was just so elusive. And I had put her aside. But I had this epiphany, which was that for as mysterious, you know, and enigmatic as Sarah was, she was such a riddle. Really, Oliver Winchester was equally mysterious in very important ways. Mm-hmm. I realized that I knew absolutely nothing about the men who made the guns that made the gun culture.
Yeah.
I knew nothing about the history of the gun industry. And it's interesting today because the Second Amendment debates so dominate our political thinking that, you know, we could be forgiven for thinking the guns are just springing from the head of the Second Amendment, as I write.
Yeah.
But they don't. There is an industry that patented, manufactured, invented, distributed, sold, and advertised those guns. And it is really quite the secret in the history of our gun culture. So Sandy Hook, to me, was a catalyst to turn the spotlight a little bit away from Sarah and toward Oliver Winchester and his compatriots.
We'll get to the business part of this in a moment. I want to deal with just some of the cliches or some of the myths that you really take on in the book. One of them is this idea that guns have always been special in this country. Because a critical theme in the book is that, as you put it, we didn't become a gun culture because the gun was so special for early Americans. We became a gun culture precisely because it was not.
Right. To explain that a little and unpack that a little so that people can understand my argument, I think our love of guns, the interest in guns, the gun culture today came out of two strands. You know, there's this very exceptional condition of the Second Amendment. But when I say that the gun wasn't special, I mean that as an object of commerce and as something to be sold and as a commodity, the gun was a very ordinary, unexceptional thing. For example, it was sold profligately in non-U.S. markets, and there was absolutely no political regulation of those sales whatsoever. There was certainly no domestic awareness that a gun was any different than a plow. Mm. So all of the transactions that sort of built up the commercial market and the civilian gun population occurred in situations of complete anonymity. I mean, sometimes it's actually amusing. The Winchester account books would occasionally say, you know, sold to a stranger, or another merchant would write, guns were sold to quote unquote our Cuban friends, or right. To be in Corpus Christi. I mean, this was very common. So I think one of the more evocative examples of that very ordinary, unexceptional aspect of the commerce was a Colt's dealer who said, you know, if a customer walks in and says today, I have money to buy 1,000 Colts, I would embrace him. What he was going to do with them, of course, would be none of my business. Yeah. And I think that really encapsulates one of the forgotten ways that we became a gun culture. And indeed, it was through unexceptionalism. It was the ordinariness of just businesses doing what businesses do. And the fact that in this country, we never really considered guns to be different than other things that were sold. I mean, today we're trying to do that. Gun control advocates are very much trying to make the gun different. But, you know, it's unringing a bell that for hundreds of years, guns were sold in situations of complete anonymity.
Yeah. When did this general idea, because you write about this in the book, when did gun manufacturers or people who were trying to sell guns, when did they first start to disconnect the moral, ethical implications of their products with the product themselves?
Well, that's a really great question, and it's a very deep one. The interesting thing is that guns kind of, the gun industry kind of started out more as guns were being produced for the U.S. government as weapons of war.
Yeah.
But the minute capitalists such as Oliver Winchester, Samuel Colt, Smith & Wesson, when they started getting attracted to the idea of making guns, you know, in the 1840s and 1850s, a lot of things changed. I mean, they were building this industry. They were the first generation of industrialists. Yeah. So they were, even in how they produce guns, they were looking at how to produce parts of guns. So their vision was already a little fractured even on that level. But their view of guns was very different from that of a general or a president. For them, you know, war was advertisement. Guns were commodities to be sold. And they were coming up in an age of extreme laissez-faire thinking, where the ethical standard was more to tend to your contracts, reinforce your contracts, take the short view. So at the start, I think Oliver Winchester saw his weapon mostly as a weapon for war.
Yeah.
So that had a certain nobility to it, to be sure. And then as he started developing his commercial market, you know, his mantra was, will this interfere with company work? You know, I do business for a living. And that was very much the ethos of their era. Again, the gun industry really developed in a way that was very apace with other industries at the time,
right,
where the industrialists in it feel compelled to think distantly about what their doing did in the world. They just had to fill their contracts and tend to the bottom line.
I really loved this part of the book, by the way, the sort of the fact that the gun, Whitney, for example, who, you know, you write a lot about him trying to sort of figure out a system for mm-hmm. mass producing guns. And in many ways, this is the story of the beginning of industry.
Absolutely. This is the story of the beginning of industry. In 1798, when Eli Whitney took on his first contract to make an astonishing number of 10,000 muskets, He was
an audacious character, by the way.
He was so bold.
And
at the time, you know, when he took this contract on, he was just bitter about, you know, the South pilfering his cotton gin, and he was in desperate straits financially, and he really just took on guns pretty much as he would have taken on any other product like hat pins, because he was facing what he called pecuniary embarrassment. So he needed to make some money, and he thought, I can use machines moved by water to make interchangeable gun parts, which is of great interest to the military, of course. And this wasn't just the crucible of guns. It was really the first record we have of industry, you know, in its very first fledgling attempt. And his letters are fascinating because things that are very commonplace to us today, like overhead costs or the problems of scheduling,
yeah,
were totally new to him, and he hadn't factored in all sorts of expenses. And so, of course, it took years and years more than he thought it would. But it is fascinating that guns are very much on the vanguard of industry writ large. They were really the first effort. And without the military support, of course, no one would have taken on this kind of
right.
contract. There never would have been that kind of demand for guns.
And that's an important myth you also deal with. There's somehow this idea we've settled in that guns were a civilian enterprise, that it was people out on the frontier, that it was farmers. But if it hadn't been for the military, or the federal government is what we're saying,
mm-hmm.
collaborating, partnering with, guns, as we now know them, wouldn't really have gotten off the ground, not in the way that they did.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I think the gun carries a very powerful kind of anti-government mystique.
Yeah.
And if you ask someone to imagine a gun customer, I would guess that their mind's going to gravitate toward John Wayne, toward Charlton Heston,
yeah,
toward Buffalo Bill. They're going to think of a civilian, a citizen, an individual, rugged individual. Really, that was almost the market of third resort for the gun industry. It was first incubated very much through the venture capital that was being supplied by the federal government, because they didn't want to have to depend on foreign markets for firearms, which made a lot of sense. You know, they were supporting the gun industry through guaranteed contracts, guaranteed markets. The Ordnance Department and all others were very blatant about this. Mm. They wrote that any gun maker would have been ruined in the attempt without this crucible of the government protection. It was
yeah.
just too risky a venture, and there simply wasn't demand.
There's another cliche that you deal with, where that guns were commonplace, and so therefore there's always been a demand for guns. That, you know, the idea that they pretty much sell themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's not, in fact, true according to the history.
Right. Again, that's a really great point, and that was one of the things that just leapt off the page in the archives for me, because I kind of went into this, I think, with the same beliefs that others would have, that, you know, guns were flying off the figurative shelves. And what I found instead is that I was reading letter after letter of Oliver Winchester complaining, you know, about incredibly small amounts of money that people owed him, and dealers who had just not sold any rifles, and the difficulty of building up this business. And I was reading letters even in the 1870s from Colts dealers who just complained bitterly that they were being asked to push, in their term, so many pistols that they couldn't possibly sell.
Yeah.
And I came to realize that with each decade almost, the gun manufacturer did have to confront that same problem. Who is going to buy all these guns? And it's not that no one needed guns, but you have to think about an industry as an industry. They were producing more and more of them, and they needed volume.
Yeah.
They needed to stay one step, you know, ahead of just what people might naturally buy.
This was a really fascinating thing that you'd get into. So gun manufacturers are trying to figure out a way of getting people to want to buy more guns. And guns were tools, so, you know, and they were reasonably well made. So you could buy a rifle, a hunting rifle, if you were in a rural part of the country, you know, if you wanted to go hunting. Your rifle would last you a long time. That didn't work so well for the gun industry. So, and you talk about how they had to find a way to change it from being, to transform the idea of being a kind of a necessity, a tool, to something that made you feel something, more of a kind of a cultural totem, a more of a kind of a commodity, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really that transformation, that long, long journey from tool to totem is a major part of my book.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I mean, I have to say to start that anecdotally, you could find evidence from any moment in history of individuals who either loved or hated guns.
Sure.
So it's, you know, you can't really gauge attitudes entirely by anecdote. But what happens around the turn of the century? And we're in the early 1900s. You know, big changes are happening in American society. You know, we're an urban society. The frontier is closed. You know, it's sort of declared closed in 1890. We're a modern economy, a more white-collar economy, corporate economy. And in theory, this should have been really bad news for the gun industry. And then you also have to couple that with scientific management, you know, which was increasing the volume of production and making production ever more efficient. And as you say, it was doing that with rifles that were actually very well made and made to last and often not used that often. So how is the gun in this new, bewildering, post-frontier world going to stay relevant, if at all? And it's really, I think, around the turn of the century that you see this huge proliferation of the mystique of the gun. And it's definitely not just happening because of the industry, but the industry had a huge hand in that that really gets ignored and overlooked. They were embracing a gospel of modern advertisement and marketing. They realized that they needed to create demand for their product. And, you know, it comes up very blatantly in the archive. You know, they'll talk about how they wanted to work up demand for a gun that they thought was underperforming. And they were using that language even in the early 1900s. They were forever advising retailers, you need to have more guns on hand than you can comfortably sell. And the main innovation here was precisely to kind of deepen the idea that the gun is associated with really powerful but intangible values like manhood or your freedom, your autonomy, you know, your natural instinct to want a gun. You know, in the 1800s, that's not exactly how guns were being sold in the American agriculturalist. You know, it certainly isn't how they're sold, you know, in a military context. But this was the innovation, really, of the 20th century gun, you know, was to make it an object that had a real emotional charge.
That's Pamela Haig. Her book is The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about America's gun culture with the historian Pamela Haig, who says it wasn't always this way. Guns didn't used to be cultural or political statements for most of our history. They were just tools. There are actually a lot of myths about the country's history with guns that Haig takes on in her book. It's called The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture.
Sort of a cycle that happens. You know, gun fortunes go up and then they go down. And you write about, as we sort of get into the 20th century, which is gets us to modern thinking today. Winchester, Oliver's you know, beloved company. It folds eventually. It really struggles after World War One, and then kind of folds in 1931. The Depression, I guess, gave it sort of the death blow. Too much expansion, you say, too much overbuilding, a little bit of hubris. These stories are great in the book, too. But Sarah Winchester, her story, she really foresaw what was happening because it becomes this idea of violence starts to become a national issue in the 20s and in the 30s.
Yeah, that's right.
Would you talk about that? Because this is sort of one of the cautionary tales for, you know, you have Oliver's ambition and Sarah's madness on, you know, they all kind of converge here. And she seems to be kind of prescient. She's sort of got it right. This is where the debate headed.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to respond to in what you just said.
Sorry.
In terms of it's just such a rich question. Sarah Winchester, I think, was incredibly ahead of her time in her conscience. You know, when I was working on this book, I came to think of conscience almost as having fashions. Yeah. You know, some societies look very, very distant into the culpability that they might have or that their actions might cause. And some societies don't. You know, they're more immediate at hand. Sarah was an incredibly progressive thinker decades before. She, you know, even before we get to the gun, she was a water conservationist out in San Jose. She was interested in race relations and justice. She was, she grew up listening to visitors talk about cruelty to animals, you know, even in the 1870s. So she was very much ahead of her time, and particularly with guns, she was ahead of her time. The ghost story might have sounded outlandish and preposterous in the 1870s when it was dog eat dog and everyone look out for yourself. But really, by the early 1930s, Americans are talking about, you know, the gun maker as a merchant of death.
Right.
And they're suddenly seeing these connections and asking, well, why is a gun industrialist even allowed to be making money off of this commodity that could be used to kill Americans in a war somewhere? So she was very, very much ahead of her time in terms of her conscience. And it's really in the 1920s that her ghost story kind of takes off as well and starts getting repeated.
There are a number of great characters at this sort of point in the story as you tell it. Really influential book at the time, Death Incorporated by Beverly Nichols,
Cry Havoc, yeah.
Cry Havoc, and it was really withering. He said this, you quote him in the book, that gun makers believed that the more men who are killed, disemboweled, and blinded, the better he will be pleased. Which is interesting, if you think about it, in the 20s, there was a really sort of strident tone out there about we've got to do something about guns. That's not a modern thing. This was going on in the early part of the 20th century.
Right. That's the other part of your question I wanted to get back to. You see two things happening around the 1920s. One is a turn away from guns, you know, and one is a turn toward them. The turn toward guns is toward deepening the mystique of the gun, and it's charged culturally. But there was, at the same time, a turn away from guns for a lot of Americans, because they were saying, why should we have this? Why should pistols be still around, you know, even in our cities? But what's interesting in the 1920s, particularly, and in the 1910s, is that there was a lot of a business-focused approach to the gun problem. They were proposing Texas passed a law to tax pistols, pistol profits.
50%.
There was a move to remove gun advertisement from detective magazines.
Yeah.
Some of the more radical views, which never would have taken off, was to nationalize the gun industry. I mean, why should a weapon of war really even be sold, you know, commercially? But what's interesting is these were very focused on the business of guns. They weren't so focused on the gun owners. Mm-hmm. So I found that to be sort of a path not taken, but it was very visible in the 1920s.
Well, we'll get back to that because that's something you come around to at the end, focusing on business as opposed to the gun owner. So I think it's interesting because one of the questions then is, so how, if you're a merchant of death, how do you defend yourself, you talk about?
Right.
And this is now, you write about how gun advocates and manufacturers start to get the reputation of guns back. And one of the first things they did, you say, was to sort of fade into the background or recede from view. Would you talk a little bit about that? That was an interesting moment. They sort of thought, we better back off for now?
Yes, that's right. I mean, how does a merchant of death defend
yeah,
itself?
Exactly.
It's a great question. I should say, too, that the Winchester executives in the 1950s were even using the term against themselves. You know, they were reviewing a corporate history once, and they wrote to each other, well, we don't want this to be a whitewash, but nor do we want it to be a merchants of death type of book.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Privately, they kind of use the term about themselves. But what happens is when they start becoming visible, you know, and suddenly they're not captains of industry anymore, they were aware of this, most definitely. They tried to become very unobtrusive on the cultural landscape. One of the things they do is to kind of point to the other things that they were making. You know, well, Colt also was making a dishwasher. Winchester was making roller skates. You know, they try to, some of them might begin to describe their business as just like the general steel business. They wouldn't really talk about making guns. One of the finds in the Colts archive was a collection of press releases from an industrial manufacturer bureau that sort of represented the voice of industry, in effect, the voice of the merchant of death. And I tell you, some of those press releases from the late 1920s would be right at home on a bumper sticker today.
Yeah.
Some of the industry's defense of itself was, you know, this is an inanimate object. How can you blame the gun? Blame the violence in the talkies, as they called them then, you know, blame bad law enforcement. They definitely began to realize, oh, we do need to highlight that there are these noble, there's this noble history of the gun in this country, and people use it for hunting, and what's going to happen to the hunter if you start regulating? So at this moment, the Second Amendment does become a little more visible in the industry as well, because that becomes a way that they can, you know, dignify the industry and protect it from the regulatory impulses.
Another technique, I found this fascinating, is that gun mystique started to get masculinized.
Oh,
and so the
yeah.
anti-gun ideas, people who were, got feminized. You know, the idea that they were just, oh, they're being overly hysterical or overly sentimental. This gender gap then comes into play in gun politics, which is really interesting.
Yes. And in fact, in 1934, during the hearings for the first firearms regulation, the attorney general noted that. He said that he had gotten thousands of letters from women's organizations, you know, and women had just gotten the vote, so they were becoming newly politicized, in support of gun control. And the NRA president, who was testifying, said, well, why shouldn't we, as a men's organization, you know, men's organization should be able to oppose this legislation? So that also feels very familiar. A lot of the caricatures that we'd recognize today were there in the 1920s. Advocates for gun control at that time were called slobbering sentimentalists. Yeah. And, you know, there was this implication that they were belittling, you know, the honest gun-owning American. So you get a sense of that critique that you hear today, that it's just like smug liberals who are supporting gun control. And so a lot of the die was cast for the politics we have today back in the early 20th century,
right.
But not before then.
Right.
Really, before then, people weren't selling guns because of the Second Amendment. Local regulations were not being fought over. So it really is a very modern phenomenon to have this polarization and this fascination with gun politics.
Well, as you said, that it wasn't. People were truly outraged. I mean, in the 20s, there's that era of gangsterism. For example, there's a terrific section where you write about the Thompson submachine gun. This was made by Colt. No laws restricting them, by the way. And it seems to this the violence that people are starting to see starts to have an impact on the sort of public discourse, I guess, and this is when they start talking about, well, what are we going to do about it?
That's right. I mean, at this point, by the mid-20s, guns are the weapon of choice in homicide,
yeah.
And that was not true in the 1800s. Americans always imagined themselves, actually, in a weird way, more gun violent than they were in the 19th
right.
century. Guns were maybe 25% of homicides in the 19th century, compared to 70 by the mid-1920s. So guns were more prominent in crime, particularly urban crime, the bootlegger gang crime, and that brought attention to the issue. The submachine guns that really armed the 1920s, that's a fascinating story because almost every single one of those submachine guns could be traced back to one contract. Mm-hmm. The Colts Company made 15,000 of them for Auto Ordnance, which held the patent. And Auto Ordnance was going to sell them to Argentina. Again, it was a military weapon and a military contract. Yeah. But the contract fell through, and they ended up getting sold on an American commercial civilian market. And almost every gun used in that violent decade could be traced back to this one production.
Yeah. Oh, would you say something about this 1934 film called The President Vanishes?
Well, I haven't actually. Yeah, I haven't seen the film, but this was part of the Merchants of Death theme.
Idea, yeah.
And one of the things that needs to be pointed out about the whole Merchants of Death thing is that it was a bit florid. You know, it was focusing right. very much on, oh, well, these people who are making these guns are evil. You know, they're doing this diabolical thing. And that movie basically was premised on the idea that the arms cabal could kidnap a president and start a war in order to make money.
Right.
And there are a few things wrong with this. One is that World War I was actually beyond devastating for the gun industry. By that point, they preferred a commercial market to the war market. And overbuilding basically killed them after the war. But it's also that there's this tendency to try to want to have an individual gun hero or an individual gun villain. Mm-hmm. But really, what we have to understand is that this gun industry was in some ways a business like any other. It was very much driven by a bottom line. It was driven by very agnostic, dispassionate ideas about doing commerce. Mm. So the Merchants of Death was kind of a lurid, dramatic term, and it did get to the business aspects, but it kind of missed the spirit, the logic that caused guns to be sold and produced, which was really bottom line.
Right.
You know, we are going to sell them. We'll find a way to make a profit. If we can't make a profit, we'll make something else.
That's the historian Pamela Haig talking about her book, The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with historian Pamela Haig about her new book, The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture.
It seems like there's this sort of switch that goes on between Europe and the United States. And this is an important theme in the book, that in fact it was one of the things that got the American gun industry, made them really productive, was the fact that, you know, it wasn't the Americans necessarily in those early days buying the guns. It was the people in Europe buying the guns. But something happens at this point that it starts to switch. Europe, as you say in the book, backs off and starts to enjoy comparatively low gun violence. And there's this really fascinating statistic that you include. This is from 1928. In the United States that year, there were 10,050 homicides. 65%, or almost anyway, came from gun violence. Mm-hmm. In France, 520. Mm-hmm. Great Britain, 280.
Well, that's, yeah, I mean, those are the homicide rates, which are, it's just astronomically skewed. Yeah, to me, one of the most fascinating findings in this book is that the gun industry really did survive in the 1860s and 1870s on international sales. So really, in that sense, the gun culture was built everywhere but America. I mean, really, I couldn't think of a continent that wasn't affected by American arms. We were becoming kind of the breadbasket to the world. And those international contracts, for Winchester, it was to the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire and to revolutionary forces in Mexico. Those were major sales at the time. So by the early 1900s, the U.S. has really surpassed the Western European countries in the industrial capacity to produce mm-hmm. guns. When World War I comes around, the Winchester Company was filling orders for British Enfield rifles, and the U.S. government, of course, was entirely dependent by this time on private firearms makers for their defense needs. So this is really a mixed bag. It was terrible for the gun business because they had to overbuild so much to fill these orders that they ended up, in Winchester's case, bankrupt, you know, still trying to pay off the debt even years later. But in one crucial respect, this was useful because when the Congress did begin to consider firearms legislation in 1934, one of the most powerful defenses against gun control was that these companies needed to be able to make a profit during peacetime in order to stay in business so that they could arm the country in times of war. That is a pressure that other countries that didn't have as robust a gun industry didn't face. But it came up over and over. The War Department stated bluntly, these companies can't stay in business sitting around and waiting for a war. So if they can't sell commercially to civilians, then our public defense is put at risk. So, you know, this is like a knotted military-industrial dynamic and complex that existed way before the Cold War.
The book is a cultural history, of course. And it's so interesting as you start to sort of tie up all of the threads, you do indirectly make some suggestions, as you put it, to unthaw the current frozen field of gun politics, is how you put it. So I want to talk a little bit about that, because what you seem to be trying to do here as an historian is to say, let's look at the way this story has played out and use that as some guidance for a way forward, a valuable shift, as you said. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because that seemed, you know, you could have left that part out as an historian.
I could have. Maybe I should have. I don't know.
I think it says something that you didn't, though, Pamela. I think it says something you didn't, because this is not I won't say it's necessarily personal, but you obviously you feel strongly about where we are in terms of the conversation.
Yes, it's to me, one of the biggest frustrations is the inability to take in new ideas on this issue and the seeming inability to listen or hear points of view around it. As an historian and a scholar and a writer, that is deeply frustrating to me. And so I was interested in, you know, is there a way to think about gun violence solutions differently? And could history might suggest that way to us. So to that end, having spent a lot of time looking at the gun industry, which is driven by very black and white ideas of you know, of commerce and survival, I do end up suggesting perhaps we need to have more of a business-focused approach to the gun problem of gun violence, and also a conscience-focused approach. So a business-focused approach would simply mean shifting from the gun owner to the gun maker, thinking more about how to leverage, exert pressure on the gun industry. And a conscience-focused approach is, as I define it, thinking about doing more than is legally required and moving a little bit off of rights talk and just toward themes like corporate citizenship, our responsibilities to each other, moving into more intangible places of what can we do voluntarily. You know, everything is about what do we have a right to do and what can we force people to do. Those are the broad outlines of my recommendations, but there are also more specific ones as well.
You get very specific. You say it's easier to fight a business than a myth. And it seems like that's sort of where we are in some ways. It seems like one of the problems is that guns have come to be perceived as commodities whose value is in their mystique.
Yes, that summarizes my book perfectly, and that's been a long time coming. It's much more a product of the 20th century, as I was saying earlier, but I do think that's the case. So,
well, you could even mention this run, you do refer to this actually. In 2013, there was this panic that in some ways, and there was this kind of run on guns. People perceived that somehow the Obama administration was going to keep them from buying guns. And I mean, it was like a run on, you know, pig futures or orange juice. It was a commodity in that sense.
Well, yes, I mean, it's definitely a commodity, but it's also become something that just carries a huge amount of political identity behind it right now.
Yeah.
So when Maryland proposed aggressive gun control legislation, the number of applications for guns skyrocketed. And in that sense, I mean, people aren't buying it just to be better safe than sorry. In some cases, I know people like this. They're buying guns today more as a political gesture of alliance and of
right.
loyalty. So that is unprecedented in our history, that the gun would have that much sort of political weight behind it. But it makes dealing with the problem of gun violence very difficult, because when we're talking about guns, we're really talking about so much more than guns today.
Yeah.
And that's a relatively recent development.
Some of the specific suggestions you mentioned, you know, trying to incentivize the industry to come up with, you know, smart technology. One of them also is to restore some liability to the gun industry, you know, make them more accountable. I also liked the point you make about establishing a code of ethics. Smith & Wesson in 1999, they drafted a code of ethics for their dealers. What happened
yeah.
to that? What happened to that idea?
Well, I'll tell you. One of the interesting things is how much some dealers are trying to do voluntarily today.
Right.
For example, not selling certain weapons or having members-only customer policy. So those examples to me are really heartening, because mm-hmm. these aren't being legally compelled, but these are, you know, dealers who are trying to do things voluntarily. So in the same spirit, in 1999, when the gun makers were facing ambitious civil litigation brought by 16 cities, Smith & Wesson got worried, because businesses, unlike the NRA, don't actually like to be visible. They don't actually like publicity.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the major gun makers were quite panicked about this. But Smith & Wesson devised a really extensive code of ethics for the dealers who were selling their guns.
Mm-hmm.
They were modeling it after the auto industry, and they had stipulations like dealers would have to pay more attention to not turning a blind eye to straw purchasers, bulk purchases. They would have to do more to keep people who were under the age of 18 from browsing in their stores. I mean, it was really quite extensive. And what happened was they suffered a boycott from the NRA as a result. And, you know, this was not welcomed. So, I mean, part of consumer activism, though, is creating an environment where companies think it is in their best interest to do more. You know, they don't have to be forced sometimes. They just need to see, oh, this is on the radar. People are talking about this. They care about how we do our business.
Mm.
I mean, it's a shame that Smith & Wesson got that kind of blowback, because they were doing something that was really admirable.
Do you think it's possible to strip out the emotional and cultural mystique of guns at this point? I mean, if we shift and start talking more about the business aspect, focus more about the gun makers than the gun owners, or if we shift to something that's less technocratic, as you say, and more related to community, do you think that could actually strip out that emotional attachment and connection that Americans have to their guns?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't think that emotional attachment would ever really be stripped out per se.
Yeah.
But other things need to be in the conversation. You know, first off, it reminds me of the tobacco industry. I mean, once the tobacco industry got to be talked about as an industry and as a business, there are young people who just said, well, you know, I don't want to be manipulated by a business into buying a product that might hurt me. So being aware of the other aspect of our gun culture, which is that this was a business, might help. Another important thing is that attitudes have always changed over time, even with guns. One of the most damaging aspects of this huge weight of the fables and the legends around the gun is that we've come to think it's always been that way. You know, Americans have always loved guns. I mean, so many of the sentences around guns begin with a phrase like that. Mm. You know, and sometimes it's people who hate guns and sometimes it's people who love them.
Yeah.
But on both sides, we'll be like, oh, Americans have always thought this. They haven't. You know, gun attitudes are heterogeneous. They've changed. They can change again. And finally, I would say I think it is possible to shift attitudes because, as Sarah Winchester demonstrates, there's this other gun America. And in that other gun America, there have been plenty of Americans who weren't interested in guns, who didn't own guns, who thought that guns were, quote unquote, implements of slaughter, and who actually quite resisted the idea that they would have to own a gun. So that other America is there. You know, it's less heavily armed. It's less gun infatuated. It's less gun violent. It worries about guns. But we don't hear that part of our history.
It's Pamela Haag. Her book is The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Pamela Haag, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. It's fascinating.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Sophie Sirois and Tim Slover, who's our technical director. We have a new short documentary at Video West this week. It's about Trevor Bradshaw, a single father from Farmington, Utah. Video West producer Josh Weathers followed Trevor to his first professional mixed martial arts fight. You can see it at videowest.org. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.